It's not surprising that people of the first century would be amazed at the miracles of Jesus, that they would be astonished at the wonders and the signs that God did by him. The manifestation of deity and nature is marvelous enough. The psalmist spoke of the marvels of God's handiwork and how his creation should convince anyone that there is in fact a creator. Psalm 19 and verse 1 says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament or the sky proclaims the work of his hands." Paul attested to this truth in Romans chapter 1 and verse 20, where he says, "Since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead," or divine nature, some other translations say, "so that they are without excuse." Again, the manifestation of deity and nature is marvelous enough, but when God showed himself supernaturally among men, we're told in Mark 7 and verse 37 that they were astonished beyond measure, or some translations say overwhelmed with amazement. So we might ask, with such reactions and with such obvious astonishment, why did so many people reject him? It was not for lack of proof. Obviously, the proof was quite abundant, miracles witnessed by thousands of people at a time. Many leaders even acknowledged his wonders and signs, but still rejected him. Why? Astonishment at his works, astonishment at his wisdom, was overcome by pride, by envy, by prejudice. These people were offended by him. They disbelieved, some texts tell us, because he was a carpenter. They disbelieved because he was one of us. They disbelieved because only a few of the big shots had believed on him. Mark chapter 6, verses 1 through 3 says, "Jesus went out from there and came to his own country, and his disciples followed him. And when the Sabbath had come, he began to teach in the synagogue. And many hearing him were astonished, saying, 'Where did this man get these things? And what wisdom is this which is given to him, that such mighty works are performed by his hand?'" Is this not the carpenter, the son of Mary and brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon? Are not his sisters here with us? So they were offended at him. In John chapter 7 and verse 48, we'll look at this text a little more closely later. The Pharisees responded to the officers who spoke highly of Jesus. They'd sent these officers to arrest him, and the officers came back and spoke highly of him. And their response was, "Are you deceived also? Have any of the rulers of the Pharisees believed in him?" But it was not only the wonders, the signs, the miracles that Jesus performed that astonished the people. Jesus astonished both friend and foe with his zeal for God. He astonished them with his ability to capture the heart of his enemies. With the extent of his teaching, he astonished them with his authority. And Jesus astonished people with the content of his teaching. For example, in Matthew 22, verses 23 through 33, the text tells us, "The same day the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to him and asked him, saying, 'Teacher, Moses said that if a man dies having no children, His brother shall marry his wife and raise up offspring for his brother. Now there were with us seven brothers. The first died after he had married, and having no offspring, left his wife to his brother. Likewise, the second also, and the third even to the seventh. And last of all, the woman died also. Therefore, in the resurrection, whose wife of the seven will she be? For they all had her. Jesus answered and said to them, "You are mistaken, not knowing the Scriptures nor the power of God, for in the resurrection they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels of God in heaven. But concerning the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what was spoken to you by God, saying, 'I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob'? God is not the God of the dead, but of the living." And when the multitudes heard this, they were astonished at his teaching. Text makes it very clear that the Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection. They also didn't believe in angels. They didn't believe in the soul connected with the resurrection, afterlife. They were the aristocrats. They were the high priests in the last 150 years before the destruction of Jerusalem. They accepted only the Torah, the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament. And so this question is based on the belief that there is no resurrection, that there is no afterlife. When you're dead, you're simply dead. Jesus ridiculed them for not knowing the Scriptures, for not knowing, as he said, the power of God. And Jesus gives a double thrust in his answer by first stating that in the resurrection, they will be like the angels of God in heaven. They denied both of these, angels and the resurrection. And then Jesus quotes Exodus chapter 3 and verse 6, where God is telling Moses, "I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." And of course, by this time, when God is speaking to Moses on the mount, Abraham had been dead for around roughly 600 years. Isaac, maybe, let's say, 500 years. Jacob, maybe, say, around 450 years. And yet, God tells Moses, "I am their God. I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob." He didn't say, "I was their God." He didn't say, "I used to be their God." He said, "I am now, currently, present tense, their God." No one could pose a problem that Jesus could not answer. That's made clear in the text that we just looked at. This was actually said of Solomon regarding the Queen of Sheba, you recall, in 1 Kings chapter 10 and verse 3. We're told that Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing so difficult for the king that he could not explain it to her. But Jesus says, a greater than Solomon is here, speaking of himself in Matthew 12:42. He says, "The queen of the south," referring to the Queen of Sheba, "will rise up in the judgment with this generation and condemn it, for she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and indeed a greater than Solomon is here." Things that men would never think of were ever present in the teaching of Jesus. Jesus astonished people with the content of his teaching. He astonished people with his zeal in defense of God's house of prayer. In the 21st chapter of Matthew, verses 12 through 13, we're told that Jesus entered the temple courts and drove out all who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves. "It is written," he said to them, "my house will be called a house of prayer, but you are making it a den of robbers or thieves." In John's account, we're told that the disciples remembered that the psalm said, "Zeal for your house has eaten me up." But the Jews were indignant. In the 14th and 15th verses of Matthew 21, we're told the blind and the lame came to him at the temple and he healed them. But when the chief priests and the teachers of the law saw the wonderful things he did and the children shouting in the temple courts, "Hosanna to the Son of David," they were indignant. Jesus astonished people with his ability to capture the hearts of his enemies. This is an account that we looked at just a few moments ago. In John chapter 7, when the officers who would be the temple Levitical guards, they were sent to take Jesus on one occasion, and they returned without him. John chapter 7 and verse 32 says, "The Pharisees heard the crowd murmuring these things concerning him, discussing who Jesus is, some speaking highly of him, others still having questions." It says, "The Pharisees and the chief priests sent officers to take him, to arrest him." Down in verses 45 through 48 of that same chapter, John chapter 7, we're told that the officers came back to the chief priests and Pharisees without Jesus in their presence. And the Pharisees and chief priests said to them, "Why have you not brought him?" Gave you a simple command, gave you a simple order, and yet you've come back without him. The officers answered, "No man ever spoke like this man." Then the Pharisees answered them and said, "Are you also deceived? Have any of the rulers of the Pharisees believed in him?" Yet some of those who were sent to take him were turned by his teaching, by who he was. Jesus astonished people with the extent of his teaching. Even the 12 disciples who were with him daily, schooled in his idealism, were often unprepared for the extent of his teaching, that which was demanded of those who would be his disciples. For example, when Jesus set forth the divine concept of marriage in Matthew chapter 19, talking about that which was from the beginning, his disciples said to him in Matthew 19 and verse 10, "If such is the case of the man with his wife, it is better not to marry." And of course, what Jesus had said was, "Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts," Matthew 19 verse 8, "permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. And whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery." This brought that response by the disciples. "If such is the case of the man with his wife, it is better not to marry." His teaching shook them to such an extent that compliance seemed possible only to those who bound themselves in celibacy. But Jesus didn't give ground. He didn't budge. Devotion to divine principles can do more than the knife or the monastic cell. There are countless incidents of those in monasteries participating in all kinds of sexual sins. The exposure of all the vile sins of many Catholic priests in the past few decades shows this. Living in a cave doesn't change the heart. Living in a cave doesn't change one's thoughts. Only submission to the will of God can do that. The true Christian will keep himself for the kingdom of heaven's sake if that's what's demanded because of his condition. This teaching continues to amaze the worldly minded. And then in Matthew 19:24, after Jesus speaks with the rich young ruler and tells him that he needs to give everything to the poor, sell what he has, give it to the poor, and you'll have treasure in heaven. Young man goes away sorrowful. The disciples asked about this. Jesus said, "Assuredly, I say to you that it is hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Again, I say it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God." His disciples were amazed. Who then can be saved? Some texts say that his disciples were greatly astonished, exceedingly amazed. Again, these were the ones who went with him. These were the ones who sat at his feet. These were the ones who heard him teach regularly. These are the ones who saw his miracles. They were part of the inner circle. They were greatly astonished, exceedingly amazed. As I understand, the answer to this question is not found in some low gate dodge around the master's teaching. Camel through the eye of a needle. This is a sewing needle, not a small gate within another gate. Jesus' response to their question, who then can be saved, was, with men, this is impossible, but with God, all things are possible. He said, well, now that kind of sounds like it's impossible. Would that be that shocking? Jesus, this is right on the heels of what Jesus had just said previously about marriage, to which the disciples said, well, it's better not to marry at all. Jesus didn't budge. How many other things did Jesus say that were seemingly impossible, shockingly so? Love your enemies. Blessed are you when you're persecuted. How many other things do we add to the list? Sermon on the Mount, in fact, abounds in enough idealistic teaching to astound anyone. The Beatitudes I just referred to. And then further on in that same chapter, Matthew chapter 5, for example, verses 27 through 30, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And then he says, if your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than your whole body be cast into hell. If your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. For it is more profitable that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. Now, I don't understand this to be literal. I don't understand that to be the major thrust of his point here. I understand him to be, for example, you say cut out your right, well, you can just as effectively lust with your left eye as you can with your right eye. So how does that solve the problem? Well, cut them both out. Well, you can still reflect on the things that you've seen. Cut off your right hand, you can still steal with your left. Cut off the left, I guess you can steal with your arms. You're not addressing the issue of the heart. But to give up some sins can be as painful, as excruciating, as cutting out your right eye and cutting off your right hand. Again, these are difficult sayings. Astonishing, in fact. Verses 38 through 44 of Matthew 5. You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I tell you not to resist an evil person. Not to resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. Whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him 2. Give to him who asks you, from him who wants to borrow from you. Do not turn away. Verse 43 and 44, you've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I say to you, love your enemies. How many people are scratching their heads throughout this Sermon on the Mount? Oh, I live by the Sermon on the Mount. You ever heard people express that idea? Oh, I just think we ought to live by the Sermon on the Mount. Really? When's the last time you read the Sermon on the Mount? We've just read snippets of it. Love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. You ever had anybody curse you lately? In some kind of way? With a look? With a behavior? With words? Maybe in traffic? Maybe, I don't know. I've encountered it a time or two over the past few years. It's not a pleasant experience. Bless those people. Pray for those people. That's what Jesus says. Do good to those who hate you. Pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. Jesus just taught us to love and be kind and get along, right? Well, he did teach that. But he taught a lot more than that. He taught a very demanding gospel, a very self-sacrificial gospel. An additional factor was even perhaps more amazing to the minds of some. Matthew chapter 7, verses 28 and 29 says that this is at the conclusion of the Sermon on the Mount. So it was when Jesus had ended these sayings that the people were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. I need to emphasize the right part there. He taught them as one having authority, not just appealing to authority. He taught them as one who possessed authority in himself and not as the scribes. The scribes quoted the Old Testament scriptures and quoted other scholars and rabbis, but authority was inherent in Christ. It was within him. He quoted scriptures to show the fulfillment of prophecies. He quoted scriptures to interrelate all of divine truth, but he spoke as the source of truth, not just one who appealed to truth. The divinity of Christ was so apparent that the honest heart could not doubt it. In the first century, people were astonished, they were amazed at the content of Jesus' teaching, at his zeal for the house of God, at his ability to capture the hearts of those who were sent to capture him. His own followers were amazed and astonished at the extent of his teaching, and the people were amazed at the authority with which he spoke. But perhaps the most astonishing, the most wonderful, the most amazing thing of all is that this Jesus, God in the flesh, died for you and for me. And he calls us to die to ourselves and to live for him. If you're here this evening and you're ready to do that, we invite you to come while together we stand and sing.